Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Haddix, and this is episode 198, The Decision to Use Lethal Force with Marty Hayes. We have a great episode for everyone this week. Our guest is Marty Hayes, director of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. We speak at length on the decision to use lethal force in a self-defense encounter. But before we get to Marty, I just want to remind everyone that autographed copies of my book, Practical Home Security, A Guide to Safer Urban Living, are now available from my website. The URL is alexhaddix.com/book. Be certain to enter any custom inscription requests in the notes section on the checkout form. Alrighty, we have a long episode this week, so we'll cut the chatter short and jump right into the discussion with Marty Hayes.
Hey, this is Paul Wilson of Karate Cafe. I'm not really a leading martial arts podcast figure, respected the world over for my opinion. But I do play one on the internet, and when I'm not doing that, I listen to Practical Defense. And now, so are you.
The legal aftermath of using a gun in self-defense can be traumatic and expensive. Get help and peace of mind through the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Network members receive much-needed financial and legal support right after a self-defense incident. They also receive education in the form of DVDs from some of the top names in the business, along with having access to a nationwide pool of attorneys. Learn about membership at www.armedcitizensnetwork.org.
Welcome back. Today, our guest is Marty Hayes, director of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Marty actually has 24 years of firearms instructor experience and runs the Firearms Academy of Seattle. Now, Marty also has a degree in law, and he's with us today to talk about the decision to shoot. So, welcome, Marty.
Well, thank you, Alex. And let me just say publicly that I thank you very much for your support of the network. It is very much appreciated.
Oh, no. I mean, I appreciate everything that you've done to put it together. I think it's an absolutely wonderful organization and completely support it.
Okay. One thing that I just wanted to make clear for the listeners is that while I do have a law degree, I am not an attorney. I haven't taken the bar, although I'm able to if I wanted to. When I was going through law school, and in fact, I graduated in 2007, I hit upon the concept of forming the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, and then decided that it's probably better if I wasn't a practicing attorney, because that way I can sit down here and do interviews and discuss the law without having to have 14,000 disclaimers attached to it.
Well, actually, that is a perfect segue into talking about the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. So let's start there. What exactly is, I mean, people have heard the promos for the past couple of months. What exactly is the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network? What does it do?
Well, the concept behind it is that we're a nationwide organization of armed citizens. We have approximately 4,500 members right now. That member basically contains attorneys, instructors, gun shops, other people in the industry, all who are working to support the concept and the efforts of the network. But primarily, it's armed citizens, probably just like most of the people listening here, who understand that if they use a gun for self-defense, they don't want to be blindsided by the legal system. And notice that I didn't say it's a justice system, because there's not a whole lot of justice in our legal system. But they don't want to be blindsided. They want to have the best representation possible. And so they've researched how to best do that. And they've come to the conclusion that membership in the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network is a logical choice for them.
So as a member, what are sort of the benefits that come with membership? What do you get for your membership, for your $85 a year?
Yeah, it's $85 a year. We have some longer-term, better deals than that. But basically, membership comprises of receiving educational DVDs, not only when you first join, but on a yearly basis after that. In addition, they have discounts off of books and other study materials that they can buy from the network if they want to. Many of our network-affiliated instructors offer discounts for their classes to our members. But the primary benefit is the ability to tap into the network's legal defense fund and get financial assistance, and then by extension, legal assistance for a fight if they're prosecuted or sued for an act of self-defense.
So that's two different types of services that are offered. One is immediate financial assistance to mount a defense. And the second part is, which I think is also extremely critical, is helping you find a legal team to mount your defense. Because a self-defense incident that involved lethal force is extremely rare when it comes from, you know, if anybody's had the Masada Ayoub courses knows that it's very rare to come across an incident person involved in a legal defense. And so most attorneys are not equipped or experienced with it. And
well, in fact, most law schools don't even teach the concept. When I went through law school, I took a stopwatch and I timed the amount of time that we spent on self-defense issues in law school. And out of a four-year curriculum, it was 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
And there are perhaps a couple questions on a criminal law test dealing with self-defense. And when I took the first-year law student's exam for the state of California, we had one question that was ancillarily related to self-defense. But that was it. And aside from that, attorneys don't get any education whatsoever in self-defense law. And so unless an attorney has sought out that education on his own, then you know, most attorneys simply aren't going to be briefed on what it takes to defend a use of deadly force case by virtue of justifiable homicide in self-defense.
And so that's, again, one of the huge things about this network is it makes those attorneys with that experience and that knowledge available to you so you can find them, because these people don't grow on trees. And so having a ready list and a ready availability is extremely critical in mounting your defense.
Yeah, in fact, what we've got going, we've got actually about 200 attorneys, which we refer to as network-affiliated attorneys. You know, they don't work for us. They're just part of the network. They believe in what we're doing. They've received the same educational materials that we give to our members, so they understand what the members know. And they probably have gone out and done their own research because this is a topic of interest to them. And they're basically the attorneys in the local areas that are going to be there for immediate help. But the help from the network doesn't end there. If we have an attorney in a local area and that attorney needs or simply requests help from us, the network, then we can bring specialists in, and we'll pay for those specialists to help that local attorney defend that case. And so that's really a pretty strong network that we've got going.
Yeah, and I mean it's almost like having your own self-defense attorneys on retainer. I don't know if that's going too far with it, but it gives you access to an extremely valuable resource should you ever need it, because it's your life on the line.
Well, it is, and that's really why we started the network. Is, you know, I've taught this the laws for using force and self-defense for 24 years now, and one of the problems that hasn't been solved, at least up till now, for the armed citizen is that legal aftermath. You know, we've learned new tactics, we've got great guns, we've got great ammunition, but we still haven't been able to really solve that immediate aftermath issue. And so that's why we started the network, is to be able to give our members at least a fighting chance in the criminal justice system. And so that's who we are, and that's what we're doing. And in fact, when my wife and I have dedicated, and we're dedicating the rest of our lives, at least our working lives, to this whole concept and the network.
Well, I love it, and I think it's a fantastic resource that everyone who is really interested in self-defense needs to avail themselves of. So let's talk about the other aspect, the financial assistance. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, we know there's two problems. One is, does a person have the money immediately to hire an attorney within that first day of the incident and to get that attorney conducting their own investigation? Normally that doesn't occur. They only hire the attorney if they've been charged with a crime. And we want that person, that member of the network, hiring an attorney immediately. that attorney then goes out and basically follows in the footsteps of the police officers, interviews the different witnesses involved, does a background investigation on the perpetrators of the crime against you. Elsewise, you wouldn't have shot somebody if they weren't committing a crime against you. And so we want that investigation done immediately. We want all the cards on the table, so to speak, when your defense attorney and the prosecutor are sitting down and deciding where they want to go with this case. And so it's critically important. We need to get that investigation going, and that's what the first part of the network does. We'll provide up to $10,000 to your attorney as a fee retainer in your name, so he can he or she can start that investigation.
Okay. Now, there are other types of insurance policies offered out there. The U.S. Concealed Carry Association has been pushing an insurance policy and various membership levels there, and the NRA has had a self-defense insurance policy for years. How do those work? I mean, from what I understand is they just provide money, but they don't provide legal assistance, or they don't provide access to attorneys. They say you find your own attorney, and then if you qualify and that's covered by the insurance policy, then we will pay the attorneys. And that's one of the big distinctions here, is you guys help provide the attorneys, and then the insurance policies just provide money.
Yeah, there's actually, I'm aware of at least four different systems or companies or policies out there, and they, for the most part, provide assistance after the fact. Once you're prosecuted and found not guilty by reason of self-defense, then they will help reimburse or will totally reimburse you for your costs. The problem is, though, if you don't have the money up front to put on that good defense, you may not be found innocent. So the insurance aspect of this is really a pretty cool thing for the insurance companies. The fact that you don't have the wherewithal to defend yourself in court anyway means that you're likely not to be found not guilty. And that's one of the things we're trying to solve. There are a couple other plans and policies out there that do provide some legal assistance up front. Prepaid legal is the leader in that, although there's no reason to believe that any of the prepaid legal attorneys are self-defense attorneys.
So those are some really important distinctions and differences in what's offered between the various programs. So people should understand, if they do invest in them, that they really need to look closely at what's being offered and how it's offered. Now,
read the fine print. The fine print is what's going to tell you exactly what that policy or that purported policy covers. And we don't have a problem with any of our members having additional coverage, whether it's through another prepaid legal plan or through an insurance carrier, that sort of thing. We just want to make sure that they fully understand what they're getting if they buy into that.
So it's, you guys are not in competition with each other, but you'll actually work with the other policies to help cover the expenses of the defense.
Well, I don't know if we'll work with them as much as we will perform our duties to our members the way that we've advertised to do that. And if the other companies want to join in with what we're doing, then that's great. But we really haven't worked out any how to work together plans. It's just not. I'm not really a big team player as far as that goes.
Okay.
We'll do our thing here, and we'll cover our members to the best we can possibly cover for our member benefits.
Okay, fantastic. So let's go ahead and switch gears now and talk about the decision to use lethal force in self-defense. Now, I know this is primarily gauged at firearms, but we do have a lot of listeners that don't use firearms but may use other tools that are available to them in a defensive situation. It could be empty-handed. It could be, the baseball bat at the side of your bed, or the, knife in your pocket. So these types of things can apply to other areas. So let's talk about the decision to use lethal force.
Okay. We've kind of modeled a lot of what we're teaching people through our booklet and through our videotapes on who I consider as the preeminent scholar in the field. That's Masoud Ayoub. And so when Masoud writes that deadly force is justified only when undertaken to prevent imminent and otherwise unavoidable danger of death or grave bodily harm to the innocent. That's kind of the opening salvo or opening the door to our teaching of use of deadly force in self-defense.
So how would you approach that?
Well, we then break down that concept into its components. The first component people need to understand is that there's a doctrine called the reasonable man doctrine. What would a reasonable and prudent person, knowing what the defendant knew at the time, have done under the same or virtually identical circumstances? And how that plays into our defense of a self-defense shooting is that we need to educate the jury, first of all, did the defendant know? What did he see? What did he hear? What did he feel? What did he smell? What was going through his mind, when he made that decision to pull the trigger? And so that's something that the armed citizen needs to be able to articulate if they have to go get on the witness stand in a trial. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is the reasonable man doctrine also applies to what did the defendant know ahead of time. And this is where it's really critical that armed citizens get good, legitimate self-defense training, because the fact that they've had that training can be used in a court of law to justify basically what they saw and how they perceived what they saw as being a deadly threat against them. And that's really where the crux of most self-defense cases is going to hinge upon is was the defendant reasonable when they felt that their life was going to be taken from them, or the life of some other innocent person in their presence or company was going to be endangered. And that's really where the crux of the whole matter comes down to. So let me kind of finish this long soliloquy by saying that the citizen needs to be able to articulate what the individual is doing that caused that armed citizen to believe that his or her life was going to be endangered at the moment that they pulled the trigger.
I wanted to touch upon that subject of training and how important training is. What sort of documentation of training do you need to provide in that sort of instance?
Well, the first thing you need to do is you need to always save all of your training materials, whether it's a 3-hour course in basic gun safety, or whether it's a full-blown 40-hour course in judicious use of deadly force, like you would receive if you attended one of Masada Yub's trainings. Yeah, keep all the materials, keep a separate training file, keep all of your certificates of completion. Even go to the extent of keeping magazine articles that are really interesting to you and educate you as far as use of deadly force. When we send out our DVDs to our members, we have right on the cover of the DVD the ability for that member to initial and date the time when they saw that DVD. And if they see it 2 or 3 times, then we want them to be able to document that. That way, when we get to court and we're explaining to the judge that we want to introduce this DVD because the defendant knew ahead of time what ability, opportunity, and jeopardy meant, then we can prove that the defendant knew that because that's documented. And so there's a premise in the law that says if it's not documented, it didn't happen. And so just because you took a training course or two, if you can't pull paper out of a file or some other way to document that you actually was there and did understand the material, then you're probably not going to get that into trial.
Okay, so this podcast wouldn't necessarily help you out then in terms of mounting a legal defense.
Well, it could. If they sit down and take some notes when they go back and re-listen to this after they listen to it the first time, and then those notes, they date it, put a timestamp on it, put in the training file. In 10 years, if they have to justify their act of deadly force, then it might be allowed in the trial.
So what would be the next step?
Well, then the next step is basically knowing how to articulate why you felt your life was in danger. over the life of another person was in danger. And there we fall back onto the tried and true teaching concept of the elements of ability, opportunity, and jeopardy. As far as I know, there are no legal statutes or legal court cases that mention these three elements as far as needing to be present when a person decides to pull the trigger. But for at least the last 30 years, they've been taught in police academies around the country and in most civilian training schools, too. And so with your indulgence, I'll kind of just take a moment and explain those, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's extremely critical. I've had lots of training in this area, and it's absolutely necessary. And there are a couple of pieces that need to be emphasized as well, but please go ahead.
Yeah, so the elements, let me explain that this is how you would articulate to the prosecutor with your attorney present, and we'll talk about that at another time, but you know, you'll articulate why you felt your life was in danger. Now, the first thing is because you knew or had a reasonable belief that the person possessed the ability to cause your death or serious physical injury. You saw the knife, you saw the gun, you saw the baseball bat. You were surrounded by four guys, and they were all bigger and presumably tougher than you. And so ability was present, the ability to cause your death or serious physical injury. And you need to be able to articulate that. Then secondly, you need to be able to articulate the element of opportunity. Did the person possessing the element of ability, or the persons, did they have the opportunity to use that ability against you? Let me kind of clarify that. If a guy is across the street and he's got a three-inch pocket knife and he says, "You dirty scumbag, I'm going to kill you," and he's sitting there leaning up against a mailbox, he may have the ability to cause your death. He's got a knife, he's got a deadly weapon, but he's not close enough to cause your death or serious physical injury. He doesn't possess the opportunity to do that. And that's pretty much with any contact weapon. And then we expand that into the concept of the Tuva drill and understanding what Dennis Tuva did many years ago and how that influences the teaching of deadly force. The Tuva drill, or the Tuva concept, basically is understanding that even though a person is not in contact distance from you and they're armed with a contact weapon, they can close that distance quickly enough to inflict a deadly blow against you or a knife cut or whatever before you can reasonably react to that threat. And so you need to be able to explain that, yeah, I knew that the person, he wasn't within striking distance, but he was closing, and I warned him to stay back, and he kept closing, and I knew from my training and experience that if I let him come any closer, I wouldn't be able to react. And so I had to shoot him, even though he turns out to be 15 or 20 feet away.
Yeah, I've spoken about the Tuva drill many times on the show, so I hope everyone understands, but it's always good to have a refresher.
Okay. And I'm pretty good friends with Dennis, too. In fact, Dennis is one of the advisory board members of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. And him and I have talked about this at length, and even one of our DVDs has him explaining the Tuva drill or the Tuva concept. And it's erroneously referred to as the 21-foot rule. And that was only because he started the concept on a shooting line, and they were 7 feet away from the or 7 yards away from the target, or 21 feet. It has erroneously become the 21-foot rule, kind of meaning that, well, if they're further than 21 feet away, then they don't have the ability to kill you. If they're closer than 21 feet, they should be shot already. And he wants to make sure that the people understand that it has nothing to do with that, actually 21 feet. It's whether or not you know that the person could close that distance and inflict a deadly assault upon you, and your ability to articulate why you knew that.
And I just also want to underscore for the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, you've mentioned two of the heaviest hitters in the field, Dennis Tuva and Masad Ayoub, and those guys are part of the network. So This is not a fly-by-night organization. This is serious, and they have the top people in the industry. I just wanted to take a break to plug that part.
Okay, no problem. Well, since we're plugging it, why don't we also plug the fact that John Farnham and Tom Givens are also on the advisory board, a couple long-time, well-thought-of trainers. And we also have a self-defense attorney up in Minnesota, Mr. James Fleming, who is part of the advisory board. And so that kind of constitutes a whole board, including myself and our vice president, Vincent Schuck.
Yeah, all I can say is wow. it's just, yeah. Anyway, that's one of the reasons why I love this organization. This is serious stuff with the top people. And so seriously consider it. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
That's okay. So we're back to ability. I'm sorry, we're stuck on opportunity. And your ability to articulate, did the person possess the opportunity to cause your death or serious physical injury? And we're discussing contact weapons, but also it extends to bare hands. If they're within a few steps from you and they're exhibiting threatening behavior, then you might be able to articulate that they also had the opportunity to close that distance and hit you, to choke you, to do whatever they were going to do to you. And so you need to be able to articulate that. And of course, with firearms, basically, if they can see you and have a clear shot at you, then opportunity is present there. One other thing that I want to cover before we go on to jeopardy, which is the third element, we need to really talk about disparity of force a little bit and using a handgun against unarmed individuals. It's been my feeling over the last several years that many of the trainers out there are pushing the concept that it's okay to shoot unarmed individuals as long as they are bigger and threatening and they're going to come and attack you. That if there's more than one, the disparity of force is present and you're good to go. It's a legal justified shooting. But let me tell you, Alex, that if you shoot an unarmed individual or more than one unarmed individual, you are 99% likely to go to jail and to be prosecuted for that.
Wow.
You better be able to. It's serious. You know, most of the cases that I've worked on as an expert witness involve good guys, perfectly legitimate armed citizens shooting unarmed individuals. And frankly, there's a couple of people sitting in jail because they weren't able to articulate sufficiently to the jury why they felt their life was in danger, even though I believe they were, or I wouldn't have worked on the case with them.
Now, when I talk with my students about this, they always try to quantify how many is too many. And I always say it's really up to the jury and what can be explained. You know, 10, 15, you might be able to, but what happens when you get down in numbers? So,
well, this is one area where the armed citizen needs to really research their own state law, their own case law. They need to get into the appellate cases and see what those appellate courts ruled as far as this issue and whether or not they were allowed a self-defense instruction to the jury based on the fact that they shot unarmed individuals. It's going to be regional. It's going to be situational. But generally speaking, you're safe to presume that ability is present if they are physically damaging you. But until they have laid hands on you and have caused injury to you, you are in a huge, deep gray area. And I know that's not what people want to hear, but that's in practice what I'm seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. There is no cut and dry rule in this area, and it's really hard to quantify, maybe impossible to quantify. Now,
it is because every case is going to be different. Every jury is going to be different. I've worked on two cases over the last several years where the first jury ended up in a hung jury, and so they retried the case with a different jury. In one of the cases, it was a second hung jury, and the charges were eventually dropped. In the other case that I worked on, the second jury that heard the same evidence found the individual guilty, and he's sitting in prison right now for what I believed was a legitimate act of self-defense.
Wow. Breaks my heart when I hear that. That's horrible. It's the worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking man on man, male on male. What about disparity of force between a woman and a man?
Well, women, for the most part, have a much easier time of justifying use of deadly force against an unarmed attacker. But that isn't always the case. Another case that I worked on where a gal was beaten by her boyfriend. She was slammed up against the wall, hard enough to make a dent in the wall. She lost consciousness for a moment. She came to, she got herself onto her couch, and then she grabbed the gun that was actually hidden in the couch. She pointed it at the boyfriend and said that, you come any closer, I'll shoot you. Well, he came closer. She shot him, and she ended up pleading guilty to a charge of reckless endangerment on a plea bargain. Because basically it was her word against his. There was some decent physical evidence there, but that he was, you know, he survived, and he was going to tell one story, and she was going to tell another. And who knows what the jury was going to believe. The bottom line is that she shot an unarmed individual who had attacked her, but there was a discrepancy on whether or not he was going to attack her again.
Wow.
So while women have an easier time of it because of their size difference, their strength difference, it's not just clear cut. Again, I would hold off to make sure that the person was actually physically attacking and also injuring before I would be willing to say that, yeah, disparity of force is present there.
Okay. Now, what about the other thing I get a lot is, I mean, children, I don't know if we want to talk about that, but what about protecting children? I've been instructed over the years, and I would like to verify that this with you, is that you, as the adult protecting the child, especially young children, are the only protector. And the assumption is that if you go down, the child is then, life is threatened to the child. So you can't go down because mm-hmm. the person who's attacking you is not going to protect the child. The person attacking you might actually be after the child. But if you go down and the bad guy just walks away, the child could walk into traffic and get killed, could get kidnapped by somebody else, all sorts of other damage to the child. So the disparity of force, again, I'd like to verify this with you. So the disparity of force when you're protecting a child and a child under your immediate care, the disparity of force argument can be used for that as well. Is that accurate?
Well, you have to put yourself in the seats of the jury. Is that jury going to believe, based upon your testimony, that your use of force was reasonable to prevent imminent danger of death or grave bodily harm to that child? And every situation is going to be different. You're going to have to spell out the facts. You're going to have to spell out your training. You're going to have to get down to the nitty-gritty as far as what the person or persons were doing, what they were saying, what they looked like, even what they smelled like if it was close enough. And all of that, all those details paint a picture for the jury so they can sit back and legitimately decide whether or not it was reasonable for you to have pulled the trigger on that guy when you did.
Okay. So again, not a hard and fast rule. It just comes down to what can be argued in court.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
exactly.
What can be argued is modified by what is admittable, can be admitted as evidence.
Yeah, in fact, I've got one case working right now where the individual is a former police officer who's retired, and his background and training is going to tremendously help him in his argument that he pulled a gun on another guy. He's going to be able to tell the jury that he felt he was threatened, and here's why. The guy was being aggressive. He crossed the street. His body language said that he was about to attack. He was using profane language. He wasn't listening to his commands. He had a target glance, et cetera, et cetera. And so the ability for him to be able to articulate this will I think, hold him in good stead in front of the jury. On the trial, yet, so I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But if you can't do that, if you can't explain to the jury why you felt your life was in danger, then they don't have the information that you had, and they're likely to say that, you know, I don't think I would have done the same thing under those circumstances.
You're making my stomach turn, Marty.
Well,
this is scary.
Maybe
this
you should
is
have
really
had a better breakfast.
Stuff. Yeah, maybe. Or at least something different. Wow. Yeah, this is pretty scary stuff. And we're brought up believing that we're justified. Our life was threatened. To us, it's absolutely justifiable. But that doesn't mean that that's the way that it'll be argued in court, or that even the pieces that you want will be available to you in terms of your defense.
Yeah, if it isn't documented that you knew this information ahead of time, then you're probably not going to get it into court. And so that's why it's so important that you document the training. In fact, one of the DVDs that we, the network, put out here a few years ago was dealing with pre-attack indicators. So our members know when they're about to be attacked, and they can articulate that they knew that because they saw the DVD that showed these pre-attack indicators. As simple as that. You know, it's, and most of what we're doing is basically out of Police Academy 101. All this stuff is covered when a police officer goes to the academy, and they learn, you know, learn how to use deadly force and self-defense, and they learn defensive tactics. Well, you know, because it's all documented and they've got it in their training file, and the instructor outlines are available, and the instructors are available to testify for the officer, they can make a good case that they knew ahead of time that XYZ was about to occur. And so that's why many times law enforcement officers will not be prosecuted what an armed citizen would be. And people think, well, gee, you know, just another case of cops beating the system. No, cops are simply fulfilling their duty to be able to explain to the prosecutor why they felt their life was in danger. Well, the armed citizen, if they don't know this stuff, they can't explain it, and so they're prosecuted.
They have a better support network, better training, and better documentation of training than the average person on the street.
And they have immediate legal representation, if not through the department, at least through their union. Before we go afield, though, probably better hit that third element, though, of jeopardy.
Yes.
And let's wrap up that little discussion before we go into some of the other issues. The third element that you need to be able to articulate for the jury or the prosecutor as to why you felt your life was in danger is the element of jeopardy. Was the person or persons who were preparing to attack you, would a reasonable person believe that your life was in jeopardy from that attack? And then that just simply falls back to that reasonable man doctrine and you painting that picture for the jury, and they're saying, yeah, under those circumstances, I can see why the person believed that that his life was in danger. And then here's the thing. Actual ability doesn't have to be present. Actual opportunity doesn't have to be present. It's only a reasonable belief that ability and opportunity were present and that the person was going to use these two elements against you and place your life in jeopardy. That is important. I think most people have heard of the concept of a furtive movement shooting. Some bad guy walks up to you on the street and says, you MF, I'm going to kill you. And he reaches underneath his coat for what you perceive to be a gun, and you beat him to the draw and you shoot him. Well, you know, and he turns out to have a hairbrush in his back pocket instead, and he was just going to comb his hair. Well, the fact of the matter is you reasonably believed that he was about to kill you, that you thought that he had a weapon, and so you were justified in shooting, even if he didn't. So that's the third element is jeopardy. Would a reasonable, prudent person believe that the person you shot intended to cause your death or serious physical injury?
Okay. Again,
okay, so
we've covered the...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. For the listeners, because of the way that we have the recording set up, there's actually a slight delay, and so that's why we're getting a little bit of talk over here. So when it comes to the jeopardy, it's... Without the lack of physical evidence, you really have to be very good at explaining yourself why you thought that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be your
word. And that basically segues right into the next topic that I wanted to talk about, and that is the concept of the affirmative defense. And understanding that a self-defense trial isn't like a regular criminal trial. In a self-defense trial, you have basically the burden of proof to prove that your actions were reasonable. And that's called the affirmative defense. And so basically the burden of proof shifts to you. If you're going to claim that, yeah, I killed him, but I killed him because I was justified, then you now have that burden of proof.
Okay. Actually, before we step onto that, because that's also very, very important, it's a real tactical decision. But I would need to emphasize immediate and unavoidable. Because a lot of the times that the students that I've spoken to and then asked them afterwards what they understood, one of the big things is they don't grasp the immediate and unavoidable aspects. So can you speak to that a little more and really try and drive that point home?
Yeah, that immediate has to be in the present. It's got to be either happening or about to happen to the point that you wouldn't be able to respond any other way. In other words, if a guy's reaching into his waistband for what you perceive to be a firearm, you know, it's immediate, even though he doesn't have the gun out and pointing it at you yet. You couldn't reasonably respond to it after he had the gun out, so you're justified at that point. Unavoidable, though, takes us into really the mindset of the jury. And are they going to believe that you used reasonable force when you had him out, when you could have just simply walked away? And now I know that there are many laws and there are many states in this country that are changing their laws and giving the individual the right to stand their ground. And that's good. But I don't want the armed citizen to just simply say, you know, I had a right to be there, so by God, I wasn't going to back down. Hey, listen, if you can cross the street and get away from this and not be involved in this, then you need to cross the street and get away. Don't stand on principle, because that may cost you, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, and you might spend a few years in prison because you simply could have walked away from the incident, but you thought you had to stand your ground.
Exactly. I did an episode on principle because I get that argument a lot with a lot of people. Well, it's my $20 and damn it, I'm not going to give it up. And this guy pulls a gun on me and I'm darned, I'm going to shoot him, by God, because it's my $20. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. That is the most inane, stupid argument I could ever think of. It's nothing but ego and machismo. And you're going to get yourself hurt. You're going to get the people behind you hurt. And you're going to just that it's. It really bothers me.
Really?
it's better just to walk away if you can, or, you know, if your life is not an immediate and unavoidable threat, give him your wallet. Give him the $20. You know, you're not his mother. You're saying, well, these reinforcing bad habits. You're not his mother. His learning process is years gone. It's not going to change anything. And you're just going to open up a whole can of stuff that you never expected that is going to seriously not be worth the $20 in your pocket.
Which really takes us into that next thing as well. You know, Alex, what's the problem, though? If the shooting is justified, it's justified, right? Yeah, I shouldn't have to worry about it. The problem is that the police don't know that it was justified until you tell them that it was justified. The prosecutor doesn't know it was justified until you tell them that. And then lastly, the jury, if it gets that far, won't know it until you tell them that. And so you have some splaining to do, as they say. You know, you're going to have to explain to the police why you were justified in doing what you're doing. And so you don't get arrested that night. And let me just kind of touch upon one concept here. It's called, it's called basically the doctrine of homicide or murder. You know, the intentional killing of another human being fulfills the elements of murder under the common law, which basically is what probably about half the statutes of the country rely upon. If you intentionally kill someone or use deadly force that results in their death, you've committed the crime or you have fulfilled the elements. Absent a justification, you will be arrested, you'll be prosecuted, and you'll be convicted. The other states that follow the Model Penal Code, which is basically a revision of the common law, that basically follows the same premise. The Model Penal Code says a person is guilty of criminal homicide if he purposely, knowingly, recklessly, or negligently causes the death of another human being. Criminal homicide is murder, manslaughter, or negligent homicide. In that definition of criminal homicide, there is nothing mentioned of self-defense is there.
Is it conspicuously absent?
If the police arrive upon the scene of the shooting and, you know, there's a guy dead and you're alive, and somebody, either you or somebody else called in and said that you shot him, then you basically have fulfilled their prerequisites for arresting you for murder. And so unless you can explain to the police how you came about the thought process that made you think that your life was in danger, then you're going to be convicted of that crime. And so that's something that we need to keep track of.
Okay. Would now be a good time to talk about the immediate aftermath? Or actually, I think we're going to do that in another conversation, right?
Yeah, let's use that as a teaser. for the next time we do this, because it really is an hour long show or so. Let's get into a couple of the problems of what otherwise would have been a justifiable homicide, but still problems where you may end up being convicted of a crime. One of those is the concept of whether or not you were the initial aggressor in the altercation. If you started the altercation, if you started the fight, even maybe it was just fisticuffs, your ex-girlfriend, you saw her on the street with her new boyfriend, and you had a couple beers in you, and you were feeling pretty manly, so you walked up to him and threatened him, threatened to punch his lights out, and he took you up on the threat, and you guys started a fight, and he pulls out a knife. Most people would think that you would you'd be justified at that point to pull out your gun and shoot him. After all, ability, opportunity, and jeopardy were present. He had a knife, right?
Yeah.
But the courts, and basically society through the courts, have deemed that, listen, you started the fight. We're not going to give you the right to use deadly force because you started it. We're going to convict you probably of the crime of manslaughter, as well. You were, in fact, justified in protecting yourself from the knife attack. The fact of the matter is, you started the altercation, you put yourself in that position to begin with, so we're not going to give you a free ride. You know, you're going to go to prison for at least a few years for the crime of manslaughter.
And that's one of the key points I like to bring up with my students is fighting is not self-defense. They are two completely different things. Fighting is illegal. Self-defense is a right. And if you start with a fight that then escalates, what you're saying is that you're still wrong.
You're going to be found wanting in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the court, because you're the guy that started. If not for starting the fight, then there wouldn't have been a problem to begin with.
Okay.
A couple other problems. At least one other problem I wanted to get across, and this comes into the realm of defending other people. Okay, you've got the right to defend yourself. There's no doubt about that. But if you come to the aid of others, then you need to be absolutely clear on what you're doing and why you're doing it. You need to be clear as far as what the situation is before you involve yourself. If it's a stranger situation, you walk into a convenience store or even into a regular department store and you see somebody's sitting there with a gun, a smoking gun, and somebody is down on the ground and you say, oh my God, somebody just got killed, and you pull out your gun and shoot, you might be shooting another armed citizen who was just stopping a robbery. You know, you've got to be able to know ahead of time exactly what occurred. There's two trains of thought here, and either of them are followed depending upon the individual state's laws, whether they're following the common law or the model penal code. The first one is that you need to be able to stand in the shoes of the individual that you are defending. A perfect example is if you walk around the corner of the local 7-Eleven and you go into your car and you see some lady getting harassed and wrestled to the ground and she's yelling, rape, rape, and you run up there and you pull your gun out and you point it at the head of the guy doing this, you know, you have just committed the crime of assault absent justification, absent the ability to stand in her shoes and say that she had the right to defend herself. Well, what if it was just simply an off-duty police officer who was working that store on the Christmas rush, and he was attempting to arrest a shoplifter. And he was using a legitimate amount of force, taking her to the ground, trying to handcuff her. He's got backup coming. He already called it in, but she was trying to get away. And so you pull your gun out, and you point it at the head of that off-duty officer who's working plainclothes security detail. Guess what? You've committed the crime of aggravated assault, and you're going to be arrested for that, and you're going to go to jail. Simply because you didn't know what all the circumstances were.
Wow.
The other aspect of defending others, and this is the more enlightened approach, is that if you have a reason to believe that another person is being attacked and you use necessary force to stop that, then it's a justifiable use of force. And so that's a little more lenient. You might not be arrested after all of this, the facts were explained. But we can't rely upon that because most people, A, don't know what they're their state's law says, and B, we want to step beyond simply the minimum use of discretion, and we want to be absolutely clear that our actions are going to be justified. You know, that means not pulling your gun out, getting involved in street situations, unless you are overwhelmingly sure of the circumstances.
So, yeah, that's a very clear warning to people who secretly want to be heroes, that unless you have all the information, it's best not to get involved.
Yeah, no, if you're doing your Christmas shopping and you're in the Tacoma Mall, as was an individual a few years ago, and you see somebody coming in and start shooting innocent people, other shoppers, then, yeah, it's pretty clear cut at that time. You know, this case happened a few years ago in Tacoma, and an armed citizen intervened and shot the murderer. And then he was basically judged a hero because of that. But that's a very rare occurrence, that active shooter phenomenon. And then so there's a very narrow set of circumstances where you can leap in without seeing the very start of the incident. But primarily, you want to be able to see the start of what's occurring too, not just jump in the middle of it.
Okay. So we spent a lot of time talking and focusing on firearms. Can we apply this to other self-defense aspects, empty-handed techniques, improvised weapons, or, say, you know, a pocket knife?
Yeah, we certainly can, Alex. I'm happy to discuss it in general terms. You know, while the use of deadly force in self-defense is fairly well decided almost on a nationwide basis, you really have to look at your own statutory laws regarding use of force in self-defense. And so the first thing I want the person to do is make sure that they understand what their law says, not just the statutory law, but also the case law, which means they have to do a little bit of research. The easiest way to do that is to go on the internet, look up their statutory law on defending yourself, type in that code, then take that code, write it down, and then get into an appellate course database on the internet. Most states have it free of charge. You can get in and do some research on your own, and then type in that code and along with the word self-defense, and start searching what your appellate courts have said about the right to use force in self-defense. And so that's how you find out what your courts are looking at that. And so, but generally speaking, you know, now that I've given that disclaimer, generally speaking, an individual can use equal amount of force to physically defend themselves from attack up to the use of deadly force. At the point that you use deadly force, it's because your life was in danger. But if your life is not in danger from the attack or the perceived attack, then you can only use equal force, or perhaps just a little bit more. But you can't use an overwhelming amount of force to stop what would be probably considered a misdemeanor assault.
Anytime that you draw a weapon, improvised weapon, bar stool, knife, club, things like that, we're now into a different category than just, say, empty hands. Is that right?
Well, it depends on the improvised weapon. You know, empty hands actually can be lethal if you're a mixed martial arts fighter and the person knows that you're a mixed martial arts fighter. Then, you know, if it's attacking me, I'm going to presume that he is lethal. He can lethally attack and kill me, and so I'm going to use a different amount of force there than if it's just Joe Blow on the street. But having said that, you know, let's talk generalities a little bit. Improvised weapons, if they're capable of causing death or serious physical injury, and the definition of serious physical injury basically is debilitating, lingering pain, severe physical damage, broken bones, that sort of thing. If that weapon, improvised weapon, is capable of causing that type of damage, and it's a lethal weapon, and so our use of deadly force parameters are in place. But it's the non-improvised weapon or the non-lethal improvised weapon that people still can employ as long as they use that reasonably. I'm talking about a coup baton, I'm talking about pepper spray, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, Marty, I really appreciate the time you've come on. I think we've covered everything in great detail. It's been enlightening and I think appropriately scary.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that the time went by so quickly, Alex. And I hope that we can do this again very soon.
Well, absolutely. We actually have plans to come back, and next time we're actually going to talk about the appropriate actions to take after the incident. So something just happens. You've called 911. Now what do I do? What do I say? How do I handle it? So we'll have you back on to discuss that pretty soon.
That is great, because here's the deal. There is all kinds of bad information floating around. And since this is an internet-based show, most of it is floating around on the internet. And so I want to be able to discuss our view of how an individual should respond and how he should act after having to use deadly force in self-defense.
Okay. Well, it's been fantastic. Thank you for coming on, and we'll catch you next time. And again,
okay, great. Thank you.
Let's say the way to contact the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network is how?
Through our website is the very easiest, www.armedcitizensnetwork.org.
Armedcitizensnetwork.org. You can find a link
and
in the show notes.
There you can, from there you can get our emails and email my wife for me or you know, read our e-journals. We have 4 years of e-journals, enough information basically for a whole book on this stuff. A person can sit for hours and read this, read different articles by different people on use of deadly force issues.
And it's a wonderful organization. I highly recommend everyone sign up for it. I'm a member. I love it. And it's really something that you should have. So thanks again for coming on, Marty. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and be safe, Alex, and hopefully your readers will, or your listeners will too.
All right, thank you.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Welcome back. You know, thanks again to Marty for taking the time to share his insight with us. I am more than certain that everyone picked up some great pointers. It even kind of left a few butterflies in my stomach. Now, since we had a long interview this episode, we don't have a summary or email. However, in some great news, we're not done with Marty yet. He'll be back for episode 200, our bicentennial, to talk about how to handle the immediate aftermath of a lethal force defensive encounter. So that'll do it for this week. As always, you can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I am Practical Def, and Facebook is Practical Defense. I also invite you to check out my book on practical home security. It's currently available in DeadTree, commonly known as paperback, Kindle, Nook, and iTunes editions. Autographed copies are available on my website. The URL is alexhaddix.com/book. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe.
Hey everybody, we are
Lady Annabellum.
Before every show, we practice. Gotta be prepared.
Exactly. And the American Red Cross wants us to be prepared too. Prepared for disaster. This
world. Just take 3 steps to be Red Cross ready. Create a disaster supplies kit with water, food, and a first aid kit. Make a family communication plan and listen to local radio and TV reports to stay informed.
It's that simple. To learn more, visit redcross.org or contact your local Red Cross chapter today. Thank you so much.
You can now hear Gun Rights Radio Network while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources.
Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.